guys, did you know this is the biggest killer? Forget about everything else. It's just as simple as getting guys around the table and talking and showing a bit of vulnerability and expressing yourselves.
Digital learning that's dramatically different. Welcome to this TED Learning podcast.
Welcome to this TED Learning podcast. I'm Justin. Around three quarters of deaths from suicides each year are men, with male suicide rates three times higher than women. It's now highest amongst middle-aged men and is the biggest cause of death in men under the age of 50. Giancarlo joins me today as my guest and has first-hand experience of the aftermath of suicide. So Giancarlo, welcome and thank you for joining us today. Talk us through your experience and how suicide impacted your life.
So for me, I started working with mental health after in 2012, I lost my youngest brother to suicide. So he was only 26 years old at the time. And when he passed, it was a real shock to our family and our community and his friends, because he, like a lot of men, kept his emotions to himself. So none of us knew there were any sort of signs of depression. No one knew he was struggling internally. On the outside, he just seemed like a fun, outgoing, engaging person. But on the inside, he was clearly had his demons. That's when we first started working with mental health, really, because we just, after he passed and after we started to come to terms with it, we were like, if it could happen to him, it could happen to anyone. So we were quite desperate to try and help stop this epidemic.
And what, as a family, you said obviously it was a big shock. What was your immediate reaction when you found out that your brother had passed?
Couldn't believe it, because so my brother's Lanfranco Gaglioni, he was a really fun, outgoing guy, had loads of friends, had a beautiful girlfriend, was doing well in university. And he just seemed like the kind of person who, you know, when you go into a room, he would bring a great smile. He would instantly warm up the room with his humor and his fun and engaging personality. So it felt really strange that it had happened. And we couldn't really come to terms with it, to be honest, until me and my brother went to his girlfriend's house where it happened. And then it became real when we saw the police there, and you suddenly realise, okay, this isn't actually a really bad nightmare. It's reality.
Looking back now, because obviously, you know, during the time you described your brother as being somebody that was kind of the life and soul of the room. Looking back now, were there any signs that maybe you can now reflecting can think, well, actually, he wasn't quite himself?
For anyone who's ever lost someone through suicide, you do question, why didn't you see it coming? It's a little bit like you see someone crossing a road, you see a car's about to hit them, you should be able to stop them. And I think with suicide, it's so hard to see what I would call like these micro behaviors. So I think me and my brother and my family, we looked into the weeks before he took his own life. Were there any single thing that kind of stood out as a cause to what led to him taking his own life? And the reality was this tiny thing. So from my point of view, the week before he did it, I spoke to him on the phone for an hour. So, you know, for us, that was very unusual because I don't know what other guys are like on the phone, but it tends to be quite quick. It tends to be like, hey, how you doing? What time are you getting to the pub? All right, I'll see you there. So the fact we spoke for an hour was a bit unusual, but at the time I didn't think about it. I just thought, oh, he's just looking for some advice. And it was at the time he was talking about his career and what to do next, something. But it's only afterwards that you look back and say, okay, he spoke to me longer than he normally did. Maybe that was a sign. And then when you start speaking to his girlfriend and my brother and my mom and dad, there were tiny little things like that where if you had a microscope and you really analyzed that situation, there probably was a tiny little thing that happened that made it a little bit different. But the reality is in the week before he did take his own life, they describe it sometimes when they talk about mental health as this idea of like a perfect storm. So everyone has these troubles, but usually what happens when someone gets toppled over the edge is that there's these loads of these, it's like getting bashed, like you're on a boat and you're getting bashed by waves and you're just getting bashed so much. That's the point of capsizing. And it's a little bit like that. It's like there's a few things that happened the week before that kind of just drove him over the edge. On a normal day, it would have been just a tough day. But for him, it was like a lot of people who suffer with mental health, it was a fog they couldn't see through.
Following the loss of your brother, what's changed for you? How have you spent your time focusing on your own mental health and that of other people that are close to you?
Afterwards, I just couldn't believe that it had happened. And I just wanted to stop anyone else going through something similar to what we did. It felt like such a simple thing, but the reality is if he would have talked to someone, the reality is he would probably still be standing here today. And because he felt the pressures on society that he had to be the breadwinner, he had to have a certain job that paid a certain salary, he had all these things that he had to kind of be forced to do. He never opened up or never showed that vulnerability, because I guess he was in the kind of, not peer pressure, but he was in that environment where he had to come across as strong, come across as, yeah, I'm going to look after my girlfriend, I want to get a house, I want to get a family, all these kind of things. And reality is if he only would have spoken and said something to someone, I'm sure things would have been brought into context and he would have seen more perspective, but he kept it all inside. And that's what eventually happened.
And that's one of the biggest challenges, isn't it, for men? As I said at the start of this podcast, you know, it's the biggest cause of death in men under the age of 50. Why do you think that is the case? Why do you think so many men do take their own life?
It's a very complex issue. And before my brother passed, I didn't really know anything about it. But since then, I've been working a lot with the charity CALM, Campaign Against Living Miserably. And become a mental health first aider myself. And I think I think the difference that I've found between men and women is, I hate kind of stereotyping and generalizing sexes, but women seem to be better at communicating their emotions and expressing how they feel, whereas guys tend not to do that. So it's very unlikely someone would come up to you and one of your mates would say, hey, having a tough day today, or I'm having a real tough time at the moment, can you help me with this? There still tends to be this kind of very resilient, strong, macho man perspective where there's no vulnerability and you don't want to be seen as weak in front of your mates, which makes it really toxic, because it's a little bit like a kind of Instagram lifestyle. It's like if you look at Instagram feed, it's all the best bits. You don't see any of the bad bits. And I think it's a little bit like that with men. They hide it so well. You see all the best bits, but you don't see what's really going on under the skin.
There's still that stigma, isn't there, of men talking about their feelings and their mental health. And as somebody myself who has suffered from depression and understanding the impact that had on my own well-being and my ability to do my job, the thing that helped me get through that was talking to other people. So what advice would you give, having gone through that yourself, with the loss of your brother, to other men who are feeling depressed and maybe don't feel able to talk to mates at work or friends around them? What should and could they be doing?
There's a lot of opportunities for them to talk to other people who are specialists in this area. So I think sometimes it's very hard to open up to your friends and family, but opening up to a stranger tends to be easier. And I think especially when it comes to mental health, there's a lot of professional help out there which is free and is just at the end of a line. So charities like CALM, Minds, Samaritans, there's plenty of support out there. I think the hardest bit is picking up the phone. Before my brother passed, he mentioned to his best friend and his girlfriend that he was thinking of taking his own life a few days before he did do it. And the difficult thing is when someone says something to you like that, a lot of the time you don't know what to say. You don't know whether to say, hey, should I tell the family? Should I go and tell his mum and dad? Should I not tell anyone? And both of them, they did what most people would do. And they said, go and see your doctor. Go and see your doctor. He'll make it or she'll make it right. And he did go to see the doctor. And I don't know if things have changed much since when my brother went, but going to the GP 10 years ago, at that time, they didn't really know a lot about mental health, in particular when men kind of talk about mental health, it's quite serious, because what I tend to find, the difference between women and men is when women start talking about their mental health, they're much earlier in the in the route of potentially taking their own life. Whereas when men open up about their mental health, it's usually when they're like right at the edge of a cliff. So it might seem on the outside, oh, they're just talking about depression, but usually it means they're much further along. So this doctor prescribed my brother sleeping pills. And yeah, my brother didn't even open the box. I think the next day he took his own life. So it's a shocking thing, but it's a story I like to share because it makes it real for anyone who kind of is on the other side of someone who says, hey, I'm thinking of taking my own life. What do you think? Sending them to the doctor is not always the best answer. I think trying to get them to open up and talk, looking at their support network and people around them who can help, and just trying to get them. If you imagine depression is a lot like a really thick fog. And when you're in the fog, you can't see out of it. But, you know, knowing that the fog does pass is the hardest thing when you're suffering with depression.
You said at the start, and I know when we spoke a couple of weeks ago before we agreed to record today's podcast, that you've championed mental health in the workplace. Just talk us through what you've done and some of the fantastic things that you've done to raise awareness of men's mental health.
So I work for a construction company, Overbury. And I think construction is one of those areas similar to other industries like football and maybe oil and gas, but it's quite a macho environment. So there's a lot of men who work for us and we're trying to balance it out, and we've got more women in the workplace, but it still is heavily male biased. And one of the things I've tried to do is when Lanfranco passed, I tried to use football as a way to connect with men to get them to talk about mental health. Because I found like with any change initiative, when you're trying to create change, it's very hard starting from a blank sheet of paper and trying to tell people to come and listen to the message and come and learn about mental health. It's a lot easier if you use like an existing channel. And football is a great kind of thing that brings people together. And I came up with this idea with my brother to create a World Cup in a day. So we said, well, why don't we put a World Cup in a day, invite hundreds of men together, play football, and at the same time, let's introduce them to Calm and the tools and a little bit more about how the charity can help them or their friends in the future if they came across something similar to what me and my brother found out. And then it just grew from there, to be honest. So we started that in 2012, a few months after my brother passed, and we've been doing it every year since then. And last year, it's grown from this kickabout in a local park to on the pitch at QPR. And we raised 80,000 last year for Calm to help them with all their work. And yeah, it's just really moving on.
And what's been the reaction from men attending the event? Have they felt more able to have conversations about their health and their well-being?
So I think it's interesting, over the last 10 years, when we first started the event, we wanted to get corporates involved. We wanted to get companies around the table to help us kind of create something quite exciting. And a lot of the companies were like, yeah, we'd love helping charities, you know, to let us know what you need. And then they would ask, what's it about? And I was like, oh, it's about mental health and suicide. And they were like, oh, no, we don't want to be involved with that. So just 10 years ago, there's plenty, I don't want to list the companies, but lots of companies that most people would recognize that were like, yeah, we'll help. But the moment they found out it was mental health and suicide, they were like, no, I don't want to be connected with that. But you flip it on its head and 10 years later, lots of companies now are behind mental health and the conversation has changed because they do want to be connected with it. But it's been a long road. And we're getting there, but it's still very early in its infancy. It's still the biggest killer of men under 50, so there's still a lot of work to do, but it's definitely moving in the right direction. And one of the things we've got with our t-shirts is, you know, it says the Mental Health World Cup, kind of does what it says on the tin. And it used to be called the Land the Baron World Cup. So originally when we started, it was like a nickname for my brother. So we started as this idea of Land the Baron. It's his nickname. Let's do it every year as an annual fundraiser. But the more it grew and the more people we got brought to it, they're like, well, all these, we want to reach new audience and a lot of them won't know Lanfranco. How do we make it accessible so that anyone can kind of hear about this event and want to take part and want to raise money for mental health and talk about it? So we changed the name to Mental Health World Cup, which has really helped it kind of grow to a new audience. And the t-shirts kind of, on the back, it says play football, stand against suicide. So it's the kind of thing that a few years ago, people wouldn't be comfortable maybe wearing those shirts, but they are now. And for me, it's just like a prompt. It's like a, it's a conversation starter. If you're playing football, your local Wednesday league and the local five-a-side, and you're wearing one of our t-shirts, it's just a kind of a, it's a prompt for someone to say, oh, mental health football, calm, stand against suicide. What's that all about? So we're just trying to keep the conversation going, really. That's all.
It sounds fantastic. And you mentioned earlier that you're a mental health first aider yourself. Why do you think that's important for employers to invest in both mental health training and suicide awareness training?
I think because it can happen to anyone. And I think for a long time, people have seen the physical and mental health as two very different things. And I think the mental health aspect of things is so, so important because it's so well hidden. And I think if people knew that, oh, well, you've got more chance of committing suicide than getting run over or getting knifed in London or, you know, all these things that are in the news, you know, the reality is mental health is one of those, is the biggest killer. And a lot of people aren't even aware of that. So when we first started working in this space, we're like, oh my gosh, we need to tell everyone, shout from the rooftops, guys, did you know this is the biggest killer? Forget about everything else. And it's such a simple, it's complex in some ways, but in other ways, it's very simple. It's not like cancer or it doesn't need multi-million pounds worth of research to find a cure. It's just as simple as getting guys around the table and talking and showing a bit of vulnerability and expressing yourselves. And that tends to be enough to kind of keep people alive.
And you mentioned that when you were first organizing the football, that some of the companies weren't happy to support it when they found out that it involved mental health and suicide. Ironically, just before we've come to record this podcast today, I was just listening to the radio and they were talking to people, to men, about them. Mental health. And one of the things that was being discussed was a lot of employers would still shy away from employing somebody if that person disclosed that they'd had mental health issues in the past. And an employer had called in to say, you know, they wouldn't want to take the risk. What would you say to employers in that situation, that if they do discover that someone's had mental health, why should they give that person a chance and employ them?
It's an interesting point. And I think for those who have experienced something like I have, you would know that for someone who's opened up and expressed that they've suffered with mental health is actually quite a strength, because it shows that that person is vulnerable and is strong enough to tell people that they are vulnerable. I think the worrying thing for me is when you look at the stats, it's the people who never talk about their mental health and the guys who kind of hide it. Because that for me is more worrying, because those people are probably more likely to have severe issues in the future and potentially take their own lives. Whereas someone who has had mental health issues and expressed their feelings and talked about it, the stats show they're less likely to take their own lives. They're much more likely to live a long, prosperous life. So I would switch it like that. And I think that's one of the things, is this idea of perspective. Without having that context, a lot of employers wouldn't know that. They would just jump the gun and say, hey, this person's got a few issues. We don't want that. It might be too complicated in our workplace. But the reality is you're bringing a real great asset into the company, because what's really interesting is what we're suffering with at the moment is we haven't got enough vulnerability in the workplace. And by having more people who are vulnerable, that makes it a safe place for everyone and opens the doors to better conversations on every office place, you know, in the UK, which is ultimately where we need to get to.
Just to summarize, as we end our podcast today, somebody who is feeling low, what piece of advice would you give to them?
When I was learning to become a mental health first aider, they described this analogy, which really stuck with me. And I still use it today when I talk about mental health. And it's the idea that everyone has a stress bucket. So regardless of your age, experience, standing in life, we've all got a bucket that we can fill with stress. And some of us have really large buckets, which can handle loads of stress. And some of us have small buckets. So part of it is just realizing, you know, where is your bucket? How big is it? How much can you take? And then just being really conscious of when you know your bucket is nearly full, what are the things that you can do to release some of the stress from that bucket? Because everyone's got different ways of coping with stress. It might be going for a walk. It might be seeing loved ones. It might be going to theme parks, whatever those things are, trying to figure out when are you going to be close to that and how can you kind of cope with it yourself? Because the reality is a bit of stress is healthy, but it's the levels where it's too much. Where with my brother, you know, his bucket was full and it only took a few things that week to throw the bucket over the edge. So it's being really aware, I guess, of your own stress and prioritizing yourself. I think a lot of the time we get pressures from work, from family. Really, sometimes you've got to be selfish and prioritize yourself. This is your health and this is, you're the most important person. And without you, other things can't exist. So be selfish sometimes and, you know, look after yourself.
Giancarlo, thank you so much for joining us today and for talking us through your personal experience, which at the time and obviously now must have been extremely difficult for you. And I really appreciate the honesty and the great advice and also the work that you're doing now to raise awareness of mental health in the workplace and generally. So it's been a real pleasure to talk to you today. So thank you very much for taking part in this TED Learning podcast. And we appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So our thanks to Giancarlo for this TED Learning podcast on mental health and suicide awareness. You can find more of our TED Learning podcast by searching with your various podcast providers, or all of them are available on our TED Learning website at tedlearning.co.uk.